From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Coming up on the show today, we'll break down the budget proposal Governor Walker announced last night.
Plus 12 entrepreneurial success stories in Milwaukee and maybe some inspiration.
The goal for me in this story was to show people what entrepreneurialism really is. It's not something mystical or magical. It's something that anyone can do.
Later, the man known as Potsy, Anson Williams, reflects on his most important mentor, a janitor he knew when he was 15.
Well, I was in such pain, and I didn't consider him an adult. He's the first person to talk to me, not at me. And he healed my heart. The words he said just captured me.
And an in-studio performance by guitar virtuoso Edel Munoz ahead of a Friday concert. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Good morning. Governor Walker officially presented details of his proposed budget to the state last night in a televised address. He had announced many of the details of the plan in the weeks leading up to the address.
As expected, it called for major cuts in funding to the state's university system, a removal of caps in the state-funded school voucher program, new requirements for people seeking public assistance, and further decreases in property taxes. Rob Hankin is the president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum, and he joins us now to help analyze some of what's in the governor's budget plan. Good morning, Rob.
Thanks for having me again, Mitch.
There are some who are comparing, they're saying that Governor Walker's budget is reminiscent of his first budget from 4 years ago for its litany of major changes. Is that a fair comparison?
I think it's a fair comparison. I don't really detect in this budget as much of the sea change. I mean, when you think about and of course, Act 10 was not part of his first budget, but the huge cuts in terms of local school aids and shared revenues and so on was directly tied to the Act 10 provisions that allowed local governments and school districts to do other things to offset those cuts. So that was really a tremendous change in sort of the governance structure here and the way we approach local governments. In this case, we certainly have some similarities in terms of what's happening with the UW system. But here, too, I don't think it's of the magnitude of 4 years ago.
Well, and 4 years ago, the word we kept hearing was tools. The governor kept talking about the tools that he was giving municipalities and school districts in terms of having more flexibility in how they spent their money. Do you see any of that continuing in this budget?
I really think that's the key question in terms of looking at the ability of the UW system to absorb these $300 million worth of cuts. In terms of 4 years ago, you could see specifically the potential savings that could accrue to local governments and school districts from having the flexibility to change the way they provide employee and retiree health care, for example. Here, we know that the governor is saying that the formation of this new authority and the ability to give the UW system greater flexibility could help them offset $300 million worth of cuts. But you don't see the clear line there like you perhaps did a little bit more clearly 4 years ago, whether you agreed with those changes or not. And so I think that's a very important question. It is hard to see where, through greater flexibility, you can offset cuts of that magnitude. And so I think we are going to see service-level impacts associated with these proposed cuts if they should happen.
Well, and I wonder if the other difference here is that the flexibility and the cuts were going into place under Act 10 at the same time, whereas the flexibility he's talking about with the UW system comes 2 years after the cuts are made.
Excellent point. And that's why I think some were thinking that while there were going to be big changes to the UW system, that perhaps the budgetary cuts would be phased in over time. That's not happening in this proposed budget, but I think that's an area where the legislature is going to be looking very carefully.
Would you imagine that the additional autonomy the system would have in 2 years if this plan is passed as is currently written, would that have that a potential bottom line impact that could, if not entirely, certainly significantly offset some of those cuts?
I think it's speculation at this point. We don't know what the exact structure would be, but we are talking about a 13% cut. And again, barring any major changes in the way you do employee compensation, which isn't necessarily the case here, it's hard to imagine how greater autonomy and flexibility is going to ring those types of savings.
The other part of the education equation is at the K-12 level. What does this budget look like for school funding?
Well, it's a very interesting topic. What we're seeing here is a provision of about $300 million of additional money for K-12 education, but that's all being directed toward property tax relief. So the way that the per pupil spending limits work, there is more state money going in, but at the same time, the proposed budget would hold at existing levels the ability to spend any more money per pupil. So we are seeing no inflationary increases. From the perspective of a school district, we are seeing no increases in that combination of state aid and ability to use property tax, which means that despite certain fixed costs that are going to have inflationary pressures from employee salaries to fringe benefits to just the cost of doing business, there isn't going to be any more money to accommodate those costs. So I think a very challenging budget for in terms of what the impact would be for local school districts. On the other side of the equation, this does guarantee property tax relief. The number isn't big. It's $5 per average household for each year of the biennium. But when you look at the way property taxes were once increasing, I think an argument can be made that is a significant feat.
The governor's other idea is to end the Chapter 220 program that has been in place to ensure integration of the area's public schools and spread that money across districts. How do you assess that idea?
Well, I think it's going to be controversial, but I think we also have to take a look at the numbers. Participation in the Chapter 220 program has dropped off dramatically, particularly with the inception of open enrollment. So we now see, I think, 2,000 to 2,500 kids. They would get to stay in the system until they graduate. Essentially, 220 would be closed off for any new participation. I still think it does drive a broader conversation about the effectiveness of school desegregation efforts. The Forum just came out with some research a month or two ago that detailed the fact that we still have highly segregated schools across the board in the city of Milwaukee in all of the sectors, charter choice and MPS. We have seen, however, greater racial integration in the suburbs. And so what has been the role of 220 in terms of those trends as opposed to open enrollment, as opposed to just other demographic trends? So I think it begs a much larger conversation, but we need to keep in mind that 220 is not nearly as large a program as it once was.
At the same time, how would the plan to lift caps on voucher enrollment likely impact public education at the same time all this other stuff is going on?
Well, a few interesting points there. Number one, this is more of a statewide issue. So in terms of the huge Milwaukee debate about school choice, not as much impact. But for the rest of the state, the cap is being removed. It's opened the floodgates to much greater participation. But interestingly, there is a limitation here that if you are what we have seen in Milwaukee is the movement of students who are already enrolled in private schools now being able to be eligible for vouchers. That's not going to be able to happen under the budget proposal, where if you are already in a private school, you're not going to be eligible. The income limits remain in place. So I think we will see much broader participation, but there are some limitations being put on that way. In terms of the funding, that's where it gets very interesting, because essentially the suggestion is that there's going to be a dollar-for-dollar transfer of any new choice students of the money that they would ostensibly be getting on that per-pupil basis from the state would be transferred to the choice program. That's going to be hit on local school districts. So I think that's going to be one of the most controversial issues in this budget.
What about borrowing? The governor didn't specifically talk about the amount he wants to borrow to fund transportation. That dollar amount has been talked about already. It is a pretty large number. What does that mean to future budgets?
Well, there's ongoing debt service. So the price you pay from doing the borrowing is that you have a benefit in the existing budget, but you're essentially spreading the cost out over the next 20 years, and your debt service obligation is growing. And again, I think several of the Republican leadership are already voicing concern with that approach. We know that there's a big problem here in terms of the state transportation fund not being able to accommodate all of the major projects that are on the drawing board. And I think it is accurate to say that this is essentially – kicking that can down the road a little bit in terms of figuring out what long-term is our solution going to be. I think it's important to note that other borrowing in the budget would go down. So whether the overall debt load that the state is going to be facing from this increased borrowing of about $1.3 billion for transportation, what the long-term fiscal impact of that is, I can't say yet, haven't done the analysis. But it is worth noting, and this is going to be controversial as well, that all other borrowing for other state purposes has essentially been eliminated.
Are there other aspects of this budget that might be under the radar that people ought to be taking a look at, do you think?
I think some of the things in mental health have not yet come out yet. I saw some interesting provisions in terms of trying to reform the way emergency detentions are done in Milwaukee County, in terms of sort of folding in mental health support into a block grant type approach. It'll be very interesting to see what the programmatic impacts of that is. As we know, mental health issues have been very big in Milwaukee County, and the governor has some real firsthand knowledge of those issues given his tenure as county executive.
The word you used several times over the course of our conversation was controversial. You would imagine that this is going to be a pretty hotly debated issue, even within Republican circles?
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating, Mitch. I mean, here we have a governor who obviously is tremendously popular within his own party and who has looking at greater aspirations. And so to what extent, given that there will be some disagreement and the legislature should have healthy disagreement with the governor's budget proposal in many areas. But how the rhetoric flies, I think, is going to be very fascinating to watch.
Rob Henken, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Henken is president of the Milwaukee-based Nonpartisan Public Policy Forum. You can find more coverage of the governor's budget address at WUWM.com.
Some Milwaukee area entrepreneurial successes in the spotlight when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We hear a lot about the effort to lure entrepreneurs to the Milwaukee area and the challenges that effort faces.
But while the region works to combat issues ranging from image to access to capital, there are real success stories already at work here.
The cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine spotlights a dozen examples of what it describes as visionaries. Writer John Ann Willow authored the piece, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
As you took on this story, how did you see entrepreneurship as different today from, you know, the era in which Milwaukee was first coming into its own? We have this vision of what entrepreneurs are, but the story that you wrote really kind of presents a different vision of it.
Well, I think historically in Milwaukee, especially, we think of the great entrepreneurs as the great captains of industry, the beer barons, the lumber barons, the construction magnates. And that was definitely a form of frontier entrepreneurialism without which we wouldn't have a city. In modern times, I think we look at entrepreneurs and we think of them as people who are looking to create high-tech, high-growth, disruptive innovation-oriented, buzzword companies. We think of those as things that people want to invest in and make a return on. And that sort of defines entrepreneurialism. In reality, my observation, my experience with talking to entrepreneurs in Milwaukee was that entrepreneurialism is really a spirit that's inside a person. It's a kind of drive to make someone go out on their own to try and pursue their own dream. Sometimes, and some of the companies we talk to, their dream is to invent something innovative and disruptive and sell it to someone larger and make a big profit. But for a lot of people, the dream is more personal, like the gentleman from Rishi Tea. They loved tea. They wanted to improve the way America understood and consumed tea, and they've dedicated their whole lives to it. They've got a new 500,000-square-foot facility down in the Menominee Valley. It's absolutely beautiful. They haven't even grown into half of it yet, and they're in it for the long haul because that's their passion.
So what really distinguishes the 12 entrepreneurs, or in some cases groups of entrepreneurs that you focus this article on, is just the fact that they want to do what they do on their own, if you will.
Yes, very much. That spirit of independence was absolutely present in all 12 of the companies that I interviewed. But it manifested in such different and interesting ways. There were a few people who found their opportunity because other doors had closed. And they realized that they'd been toiling in organizations and that the problem wasn't that they weren't good. It was that it wasn't a good fit. So they went to build a different culture, a different model, one where they felt that they could do better and maybe provide a better environment and do business in a different way.
So not all of these entrepreneurs are even homegrown. We've heard about the difficulty that the Milwaukee area sometimes has in attracting people to come here and start a business. But you do write about several people, including some who have started a water-related business who did just that.
Yeah. Sunit and Ahmed were originally from Canada. They had relocated to the West Coast. One of them, Ahmed, was they met when they were working at Microsoft. One of them was working on Xbox and one of them was working on Windows 7. They both had six-figure incomes, both young guys. And they had very real, very personal concerns about the water supply. And they had an idea for how they could use technology to improve water quality in communities. They got connected to our Water Council's entrepreneurial program, the incubator program called The Brew, and they were accepted into the program. And when they got here, they were so impressed with the level of support, the quality of available employees. They're educated. They're hardworking. We've got the School of Freshwater Sciences right here at UWM. And they have no intention of leaving now. And originally, they were just here for the incubator.
Over, perhaps so way over on the other side of the coin, if I can mix a metaphor, is Julie Kaufman and Fixed Developments, which is very much more a homegrown sort of company, doing some really Milwaukee-specific things.
Exactly. Julie's a true social entrepreneur. In addition to Fixed Development, which developed the Clock Shadow Building, which is a green building and was a community-funded project that's doing very, very well down in Walker's Point. She's also instrumental in a micro-investment group called Fund Milwaukee that anyone can join, anyone with the power to invest up to as little as $1,000, not even at a shot, but a total of $1,000. It's a group investment forum, and she was very involved in putting that together along with a lot of really hardworking people in the community. And that's just become her whole life focus. And she quit a six-figure job when she was pregnant with her second child to start this. She was just driven from within.
We've talked about a tea company. We've talked about a water-based company. We've talked about a development company. Where does Soch fit in?
Soch is a service-based company. They started, way back in the late 90s doing web development. It was Jeanette and Michelle working together at a small web development firm. Michelle was actually the receptionist, and Jeanette was a technical writer. And because they were such a small crew, they were all learning to write HTML in 1996 when we're just starting to put up web pages. And they said, hey, you know, we can do this better. We don't need to charge $25,000 for four HTML pages. We can serve small businesses. Over the years, their model evolved into a social media delivery company. And now they serve clients like Briggs & Stratton, Johnsonville Brats. I mean, they've got some really big clients. And I think they've got like between 15 and 20 full-time employees and just really great offices downtown. They're pursuing their passion. They've been able to, and additionally, raise kids, stay healthy, travel the world, participate every year in South by Southwest. I mean, they've really built a nice life for themselves.
What do you hope people take from these stories? Not everybody necessarily thinks of themselves as a future entrepreneur, but what would you hope people get from reading these stories?
One of the major factors that's going to drive economic development and growth in this country going forward is starting new companies. New jobs come from new companies. That's where our growth will come from. That's where a return to prosperity, if there is one in sight, is going to originate. I think that the goal for me in this story was to show people what entrepreneurialism really is. It's not something mystical or magical. It's something that anyone can do. even if it's not something you want to do, working in a small company or working in a new and growing company is a really fantastic experience. And even if that's not what you want to do, it's great if you can have a window into it. On the other hand, if you think you might be entrepreneurial, maybe when you look at some of these people, you see yourself a little bit.
Well, they're all really interesting stories. And John and Willow, thanks so much for sharing some of them with us.
Thanks for having me.
John and Willow's story, The New Entrepreneurs, How They Made Their Mark, is the cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. There is a link to it from WUWM.com.
A quasi-Milwaukeean returned to his quasi-home back in December to talk about his recent memoir. We'll explain when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Okay, so he's not really from Milwaukee, but Anson Williams is forever associated with the fictitious Milwaukee portrayed in the 1970s and 80s sitcom Happy Days.
Williams played the hapless Potsy Weber for 10 years on that series, and while it's Henry Winkler's Fonz who has the statue in Milwaukee, Williams has his fans as well.
We caught up with Potsy, or Williams, back in December as he was about to visit Milwaukee to talk about his recent memoir. Singing to a Bulldog is based on lessons he learned from the unlikely mentor he had as a teenager. Anson Williams, welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be on.
It's been 30 years since Happy Days ended its run on network TV, and you have had a distinguished career that has included producing, directing, many other acting parts, and as an entrepreneur. And yet, on the cover of your book, there you are as Potsy. Is it safe to assume you don't mind that image that people still have of you from as long ago as 40 years?
I wanted to have an emotional attachment to the book. And I just thought, you know, that picture, I think, would bring a smile and get people to open it and to start reading that book with good feelings and a connection.
Absolutely. I mean,
whole book is about connection. So it was actually a gift to be able to use that picture.
It is. I think when you say the name Anson Williams, it is probably the image most people have is of, if not this exact picture, but certainly a picture along those lines.
It's interesting. We've been fortunate, the entire cast, in being able to do so many other things. I mean, I sang Elmer Griffin 25 times, had my own, variety special through the years, other acting parts. We go on TV promoting the projects we direct. So I think they're familiar with the character and also who we are as people too, because we've been around long enough to be able to, to accomplish that. But it was interesting when Happy Days started. I wasn't used to that kind of popularity at all, and especially not being called a character name when you've been called your name
right,
your whole life.
Right.
And I complained to Ron Howard, and Ron said, "What are you complaining about? I got Richie and I got Opie." And then he said something really wise. He said that, Anson, we have to earn our names. We have to do other things to earn our names. And that was very insightful and life-changing for me.
Well,
and I think all of us through the years, especially Henry and Ron, myself, Don Most, we've earned our names too.
I think there's an anecdote you tell in the book about the four of you, or maybe it might be that Ron Howard was not there, but one of the first times you all went to a publicity appearance on behalf of Happy Days, and at one point Henry Winkler turns to you and says, "This was more exciting than my bar mitzvah."
Right. It's true. I mean, here we are, four young guys, fighting for dates, and all of a sudden you're hot. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the ride.
Well, so let me ask about the book. You frame it with the lessons that you write that you gained from your stint working as a janitor's apprentice, essentially when you were a teenager.
Assistant janitor.
Yeah, okay. Assistant janitor. It came at a time, you know, these were not the happiest of teenage years for you.
No, actually, my upbringing was harsh. My dad came out of World War II, and it was harsh. And because of it, I was pretty much a mess. I knew everything I did wrong. I didn't know anything I did right. I was confused. I was just so unconfident. And, you know, we didn't have money. So anything extra you wanted in life, you had to go out and get a job and pay for, which is fine. And I got a job at 15 years old at Leonard's department store in Burbank. And they hired me as an assistant janitor. And the head janitor was a man by the name of Willie Turner, who was African-American, in his 50s, illiterate, and a functional alcoholic. But without this man, I wouldn't be talking to you today. This man was the first man to ever talk to me, not at me. He called his janitorial room the talk room. And there'd be two oil drum cans in there and then janitorial supplies and whatever. And when we weren't working, he would talk to me. He had such an innate sense of who I was, what I was good at. He knew how to inspire me. He gave me life lessons I couldn't pay for. Again, without him, I'd be less than a number in the world. And the book, you know, yes, is 30 stories that are fun and entertaining and maybe insightful and maybe interesting to people, but there's always a bigger story in each story. It takes the reader back to the talk room where they can have a chance to meet Willie. They have they would have a chance to have the same words that inspire me to help me find myself. Like Willie would tell me, boy, don't get in the way of yourself. You don't get in the way of yourself, you know? And you don't look at the mountain. You climb the mountain, boy. You move forward. You climb the mountain. That's who wins, boy. I mean, lesson after lesson in terms of priority and clarity. In fact, the reason for the title, Singing to a Bulldog, that same first year at 15, we were unpacking refrigerators for the appliance department. And back then, the big deal was that the freezer compartment didn't freeze up. It just stayed cold. So I look at Willie, and I say, you know, they should put up a sign, freeze your food, not your freezer. He goes, that's good, boy. That's a gift. That's, you got the words to sell. You find opportunity. That's a gift. You use that right. That's powerful. You got a gift. It's the first time I knew I had entrepreneurial abilities. 2 days later, there's a banner across the entire appliance department. Freeze your food, not your freezer. Willie had talked to the manager. They sold out of refrigerators. Do you know what that meant to me, this 15-year-old unconfident kid who's never done anything great in his life? To have my idea there for the world to see, and it actually was positive, it worked, it changed my life. Well, aside from many more lessons and inspiring conversations, that particular find that Willie found in me, years later, I used on Happy Days, always looking for the opportunity.
And so this kind of connects with where the book gets its title, right?
Back then, we weren't paid the same kind of salary stars are today, nowhere near. We did fine, but you don't get rich.
Right.
So I'm looking for opportunity, like on the show. How can I improve myself? Where is there more opportunity? How can I grow? How can I climb my mountain? And then it hit me. David Cassidy's singing on the Partridge Family. He has a record contract. He's singing all over the world, off the show. The Brady Bunch, they're singing now off the show, record contract. Well, I sang in nightclubs and all that years before. And I thought to myself, if I can convince Gary Marshall to put a band on the show with me singing, I could get a record contract, and I can get booked for concerts all over this country, and I can make some money. So I tracked Gary down. He didn't have a lot of time. And he told me, hey, I don't have what? Talk to me later. I don't have a lot of time. I go, no, it'll only take a minute. He said, you only got a minute. So I had an elevator pitch to change my life. He goes, walk with me. So I'm walking with Gary, and I quickly tell him, you got girls on the show. You got cars on the show. You don't have music. You need a band. We'll have a band at Arnold's. Richie can be in it. Ralph can be in it. I sing. It'll be great for the show. Wait a minute. He stops me. Wait a minute. A band. And you sing. Yeah, you sing, right? I go, yeah, yeah. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. You're good? I'm okay. Ah, a band. I like that. I used to be a drummer. Okay. There's a show coming up. a frat party. I can fit it in the show. Go pick a song. Go to Bobby in the office. Go pick a song. Yeah, that's a good idea. Starts walking away. I'm thinking to myself, I just changed my life. I'm singing on national television. I'm going to get a record deal. Oh, my. And then he turns back to me. But Anson, what? You're singing to a bulldog. Why? Well, I don't have time to listen to you. If you're good, I get laughs. If you're bad, I get laughs. You're singing to a bulldog. So there I was, the first time on national television, singing, I'm all shook up, to a bulldog. But that moment of singing to that bulldog was more than just music. Gary liked it. He put the band in numerous episodes. I was in charge of the music that I did on the show, which gave me another responsibility, which was just a great education. I got a record contract. I started getting booked all over the country, and I made much more money off the show than on the show. So singing to a bulldog was the precise moment when I started to climb my mountain. Jump the Shark came from Happy Days. The precise moment when success starts to decline, singing to a bulldog is the precise moment when you start to climb. And I wanted the book to have that same inspiration for all the readers. Well, by reading this book and by paying Willie Turner's lessons forward, they will have the tools to start the climb, to have their bulldog moment.
Can I ask about the concept of jumping the shark? Because it's kind of entered the popular lexicon, and it goes well beyond Happy Days. In fact, people might not even think of it as coming from Happy Days.
Yeah.
Was there an awareness of jumping the shark as the shark was literally being jumped?
No, not at all. In fact, it's interesting because I think that was only the fifth season of the show. It went on for 10 years, so it doesn't. It really wasn't the start of the decline of Happy Days. The jump the shark moment for Happy Days to me was when Ron and Henry left, because the it factor of that show was the chemistry.
Yeah,
and you can't repeat it. That to me, the seventh or eighth season, that to me was the jump the shark moment. Honestly, but I want jump the shark moment. I want singing to bulldog. I want the bulldog moment to be as popular as the jump the shark moment, because it's the polar opposite. It's the pause. It's climbing, not declining.
You met Willie Turner when you were 15.
Yes.
That's an age when teenagers don't always want to listen to adults. Was there something about Willie at the time you were 15 that made you sit up and take notice?
Oh yeah. I was in such pain, and I didn't consider him an adult. He's the first person to talk to me, not at me. And he healed my heart. The words he said just captured me and turned my head around into a positive place. And every day I found out more I could do instead of what I couldn't do. Because of him, I had the clarity and the confidence and the strength to move forward. So, it didn't even dawn on me not to listen to him. It's just everything connected that he said to me.
One of the things, remarkable things you write about was your being there when Robin Williams was given the chance to play Mork from Ork in an episode of Happy Days, which many people forget, which then spun off to become Mork and Mindy. You say right away people recognized his genius. I was just wondering if you would reflect on a life cut short as Robin's was.
I can reflect more on his what's going to be forever. You know, I mean, Robin was the kindest, most gentle man ever. Maybe too sensitive to the human condition. And I don't, you know, and a lot of times that kind of genius, you know, I just don't know what went through him, what he had to put up with to have that kind of sensitivity and that kind of connection and that kind of clarity of what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. It had to be so complex. So I'm not about to judge, you know, a long life, short life. All I know is during his life, he's given more than most people do in 10 lifetimes. And those 10 lifetimes are going to be around for 10 more lifetimes. His genius, his abilities to make people laugh and educate and understand are evergreen and forever.
Well, I know our time is relatively short in this interview, but I wanted to ask, have you visited Milwaukee in recent years?
The last time I was there was for the Bronze the Fonz dedication.
Well, I was going to ask if there is a picture of the real Potsy, if you will, with the fake Fonz.
The real Potsy with the fake Fonz. You mean Anson with the fake Fonz?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, sure. I'm sure there are. They took tons of pictures that day.
Would you wish that there were a Potsy statue nearby?
I don't wish it. I wouldn't mind it, but I don't wish it.
Well,
how about a gold one?
A gold Potsy.
Then I'd have security and the Fonz wouldn't.
Well, Anson Williams, I hope we can all sing to a bulldog. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Anson Williams' recent memoir is called Singing to a Bulldog. Williams, who was best known as Potsy Weber on the sitcom Happy Days, was in Milwaukee in mid-December.
Coming up next on the show, a preview of music on tap this Friday at Latino Arts. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Among the many cultural events that Milwaukee's Latino Arts has put on over the years, the musical offerings are among the most distinctive.
Thanks to the efforts of multi-instrumentalist and teacher Denora Marquez, the Latino Arts String Program has been providing top-notch education free of charge to low-income Latino students across Milwaukee.
The program expanded last year to include a guitar festival for area youth, and it was so successful, it was expanded this year to include not only a competition for the students, but master classes for them as well. On Friday night, the winners of the competition will play a concert along with Nemanja Ostojic and guitar virtuoso Edel Munoz. He's also on the faculty of the string program, and we're hearing him right now playing a piece called One Day in November. So beautiful. So beautiful. Edel Munoz in Lake Effect's performance studio along with Denora Marquez. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having us here, Bonnie.
Ah, so beautiful. And those are the kinds of sounds we are hoping to hear in this next. This is the second annual guitar competition at Latino Arts. Is that correct?
It's actually the second annual guitar festival, International Guitar Festival. And this is the first year we're hosting a youth competition along with the festival.
You've been running the program, the music program at Latino Arts for a long time. Why an international guitar festival, and why the competition?
Well, yes, I've been running the program now for almost 13 years, and ever since I started the program, I had the dream of finding the right instructors to create a really fabulous pre-college guitar program in town. And as it turns out, we now have among us. It's a huge blessing for us. Edel Munoz, who's a fabulous, internationally renowned guitarist, who came to us and said, this is my hometown now. I'd really like to work with you all. And so it's a huge blessing because now our advanced students, this is the caliber of a teacher they get to work with. And also, right a year before that, we had the arrival of Sara D'Ippolito, which is she's a fabulous Italian guitarist as well. And so we have this amazing team. And, of course, when you have people of that caliber working with you, they have fabulous ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so Adele said, I would love to start this festival through our program. And, of course, we want to support his creative ideas as well. And so we decided to go ahead and do that, along with my dream was to have someone who would create a classical guitar orchestra, which is actually happening this year as well. So we have quite a few students. We're preparing them. It's a pre-college preparation program in classical music, and now we have them working with the guitar students. And as we kept working, we realized that there wasn't really this kind of a competition locally for young musicians, for young classical guitarists. And so we decided to just start one of ourselves.
What kinds of things would somebody win if they won the competition? Is it an opportunity to record? You know, what are you coming up with that you think the students would like?
Well, right now what we came up with is they will definitely be featured in our concert, which the festival concert, which features, of course, Mr. Munoz. And the students would be able to open for the concert. And then also the top winner for the advanced competition is winning a very nice classical guitar that was donated to us by Brass Bell. And the winner of the intermediate is winning a $200 gift certificate also to Brass Bell, also through donations from them. So we're getting sponsorship, and it's really nice to see people that are interested in making this happen.
One of the great things, this is actually not on the competition day itself, but it's a week later, it's like the following Friday, is that there is going to be a performance associated with this, and Adel Munoz, and who is the other person who's going to play?
The other performer is Nemanja Ostojic, and you probably said it better than I did.
Nemanja Ostojic.
So, fabulous Serbian guitarist, also winner of at least 16 international competitions, and you know, he's a good friend of Mr. Munoz's and a great colleague. So we're always bringing classical guitarists that represent different countries. That's the name of the International Guitar Company.
Right. And also introducing students to different styles, different ways of approaching the repertoire.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, the concert is on the 6th of February at the Latino Arts Auditorium. The following day, the students also have a chance to have master classes with Mr. Stoyak and Mr. Yuan, who was our soloist last year for the festival concert.
So another opportunity to learn.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's really wonderful.
Well, before we talk anymore, I want to hear some more music. And I'm hoping Mr. Munoz will play something for us. I think this is a Scarlatti sonata. Edel Munoz performing Domenico Scarlatti's Sonata in A in Lake Effects Performance Studio. Muchas gracias, señora. Donora, you've been doing this for 13 years now at the Latino Arts, the Latino Arts String Program. In that time, how has it changed? Are students more prepared? Are students more interested? You know, things have changed so much since I've been here in Milwaukee. I can only imagine that it's changed for you as well.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's one thing that has not changed that makes me very, very happy. The enthusiasm for the program. When I came to the United Community Center to propose the program and I met with a group of about 500 parents there, I announced the idea of the program and I had 100 people sign up just that night. And that was 12 years ago. I've already had students that have graduated from high school, from college. Our track record is beautiful in the sense that the students that go through our program, 95% of them are going to college, and the ones that have gone have graduated. So this is really wonderful. So the enthusiasm is definitely there. The way that it has changed is that the first generations were the trailblazers. In our community, there had never been anything like this program before, you know, a very serious pre-college training classical music program that focuses on developing our knowledge and techniques through Latin American music. So that's what differentiates it from other wonderful programs in town. The trailblazers, you know, had the enthusiasm in the get-go, but they had never seen what was possible. And the next generation, as they've seen the trailblazers reach certain goals, are surpassing them because they see what is possible now. You know, and that's what's so wonderful. There's a whole generation of kids that we call the belly babies because they were in their mama's bellies when their older siblings were starting or playing the instrument. So when they enter the program, it's like they were born with an instrument in their hands. And what they see as possible is you know, what their siblings are doing in high school that they're not doing in middle school. You know, so it's really wonderful to see how that works.
And it also introduces non-Latino audiences to this incredible wealth of music that I think most of us who are interested in classical music have focused on Europe. But if you just look south, there's so much in Central America and in South America that is very much in the Caribbean, part of the classical tradition, but also it combines the folk traditions and it creates a whole new thing.
Yes, that's so true. And, you know, it is wonderful to be sort of ambassadors of that whole world, that whole set of cultures that we can represent as Latin Americans. But also, as I was speaking to my students, and I asked them, you know, what if you had to say something about the program or if you had to say something to somebody that had power that would help you, what would you say? And, you know, time and time again, it was really interesting that several of them were saying, you know, this playing our music, the music from our traditions, not only teaches us about our traditions, because being in this country, we don't get to learn. We don't have heritage education. And so not only does it do that for us, but it also strengthens us and takes us out to the greater community and helps us become ambassadors of our cultures. So they're very conscious of this reality.
Do you find that any of the students have also become composers? Are they trying to take their traditions and create something new in that way as well?
As a matter of fact, it's funny you should ask, because last night after the rehearsal, I had several of them sitting back in practice rooms and just creating new arrangements to pieces that we've been doing. There's two or three of them that are actually composing their own things. Within this tradition, there's three or four of them who are composing in other styles that they like. One of them is really delving into trying to do something on guitar with classical music. They really are. They're just bursting at the seams with creativity, and it's really exciting. And seeing that has made me want to take the older students into another facet of our program, which is we're calling it Music for Social Change, which is we're gathering every Wednesday at our rehearsals towards the end. We have a conversation about issues that are important to them as young people, as Latinos, as various struggles in the families or various joys and celebrations. And now we're going into the process of trying to translate that into music, into song or not sung, into classical or other genres. It really depends on what they want to do. So, yeah, we're really delving into that whole side of their creative selves.
So it's guitars and strings and so much more.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about particularly this guitar competition and about the Latino Arts String Program in general. And Adel, I'm hoping that you will play us out with something. And Denora, please tell me the name of this. It's a Cuban piece, which is from Adel's heritage.
Yes, it is. This piece is called Guajira a mi Madre. And it's tradicional. It's kind of a classical piece created from a traditional piece.
All right. Mm-hmm. And before you start, thank you both so much. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias. Thank you.
Guitarist Adel Muñoz will play a concert along with Nemanja Ostojic and the winners of the second annual Latino Arts Guitar Competition this Friday night at the United Community Center on the Near South Side. Denora Marquez is the head of the Latino Arts String Program. Marquez was recently honored with the state's 2015 MLK Heritage Award along with civil rights pioneer Vel Phillips. There is a link to more about the concert from WUWM.com. And that's the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.